Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show. Although it's a little bit of an amalgam, Julie's still fly fishing in Argentina, so joining me today is Jack, who's normally on Thursdays. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, Phil. How are you?
Doing pretty good, although it's darned chilly outside.
I'll say. Yeah, I had to catch a ride this morning.
You didn't ride your bike?
I did not. Well, actually, I have a flat tire on my bike, and rather than walk, I caught a ride.
Yeah. Well, that's a good excuse, too, flat tire.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's. I may have slashed it myself just to give myself an excuse, yeah. But no, I didn't.
Now, that's thinking ahead.
Yeah. It is cold out there, though. I'm glad I wasn't on foot the whole way. What's in the forecast?
Well, glad you asked. It looks like more cold. Although today it's going to get to a high of 21 degrees with a 20% chance of snow coming, looks like mostly in the afternoon and evening, a slight chance of snow showers, then mostly clear tonight, low of 6 degrees. Although there's pockets. We were having dinner with friends down in the southern part of the county, and driving back one of those little pockets along 95, it hit minus 9 degrees on the car thermometer. Then it warmed back up to a balmy plus 2 at the house.
Yeah. Yes, balmy indeed. So at 21, we're not even going to... driveway has no chance of thawing.
It looks like it continues to warm up through the week. Wednesday, we're going to hit 24. Thursday, a high of 27. And that's going to hang in there until Saturday. It might take a nick above freezing, 33 degrees.
Well, that's exciting. That could be my chance to actually get, like... If it holds there long enough, I could actually get the driveway clear.
You might. Mm-hmm. We complain about the weather, but this is great weather for skiers, and it's also good weather for caribou.
Ooh.
Which is our segue to this morning's topic. We have wildlife biologist from the Kalispell Tribe, Bart George, in with us to talk about caribou. Good morning, Bart.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
I think this is your first time on The Morning Show, but you've done some radio before we were talking about.
Right, a little bit. Podcasting as well. So this is sort of a new experience, but certainly new to you guys.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the show. And let's start a little bit with your background. Tell us about Bart and why you're interested in this and what you're doing with the project.
You bet. Well, I grew up in Midwest in Iowa and studied environmental science there. As a wildlife biologist, Iowa's not a terribly exciting place. You're pretty limited there. The Northwest is certainly more attractive insofar as our species selection. And then Northeast Washington, North Idaho are like a zoo compared to the Midwest. We have all kinds of great species up here. Yeah. So right after college, moved out to the state of Washington and started working on hydropower mitigation projects. That landed me in Ponderay County and then subsequently with the Kalispell Tribe, where now my primary focus is endangered species recovery. Including caribou and grizzly bears and lynx and wolverines and some of the ones that are really hard to find.
Now, tell us a little bit about that endangered species. It seems somewhat intuitive that if a species is in danger, there's threats and all that to it, but there is a legal status to that as well.
Right. So, you know, we hear people talk about endangered species and that term kind of gets thrown around sort of willy-nilly, and it's not always accurate. Endangered species status, official status, is an official designation, and that would, you know, it has a whole set of protections and requirements that go into ESA listing. So, you know, you hear people talk about, you know, wolves are now off the endangered species list. They're recovering, although they're not everywhere, right? So, lynx are, you know, in the process maybe of being listed. Wolverines are, they're talking about, there's all these species that are, you know, maybe on the brink in one place and doing well in another. So there's some political wrangling that goes into endangered species status for the official designation.
Yeah, and there's the age-old problem of how you actually determine population levels and if you can, you know, what's a healthy level? What does it mean? And so with caribou, we know a little bit more by virtue maybe of the fact there aren't so many to count.
They're pretty easy to find, actually. You know, caribou sort of isolate themselves in the winter, and they live in high elevation areas. You mentioned, like, survey techniques and sightability. Caribou are pretty easy to survey compared to some of these other species. Like I mentioned, wolverine and lynx and some of these animals are a little tougher to find. Caribou live in high country all winter long. Finding them is pretty easy. It's pretty straightforward. We take a fixed-wing aircraft and fly around until we see their tracks, because they kind of mill around and live in these cirques, and they track the area up really well. And once we find that, we know we're, you know, getting close, and we circle until we see the animals. And counting them is a pretty straightforward project for us.
And so how are they doing? What's their range look like today? And do you have an idea of how many animals there are?
We think we know exactly how many animals there are. We're going to know more here in a week or so when we do our late winter flight. But we're down to about 11 animals. Last year we had 12 in the South Selkirk herd. And that range, you know, it extends. It's a lot of it in Canada. It extends into North Idaho, down around Priest Lake. Little Snowy Top's a pretty popular spot for them up on the border of Washington, Idaho, and British Columbia. You know, and then kind of we get back into the political, you know, recovery area, which is an Endangered Species Act a piece of that. That recovery area is, you know, 35 or so thousand acres, and extends all the way down the west side of Priest Lake and through the Salmo Priest Wilderness area and some of that country. The animals tend to stay fairly close to the border, about 10 miles north or south of the Canadian border. So, you know, it'd be fair to say that's where they live 90% of the time.
They're not necessarily there trying to go back and forth. They don't recognize the border. It's just a good
habitat. Yeah, they don't
know
the border's there, yeah. Well, you know, the border's doesn't mean anything to them, but they tend to stay pretty close to BC Highway 3 and in that area.
So tell us why. What is it about that specific location, that habitat, that they seem to prefer?
Well, they've lived there for, you know, 70,000 years. The animals have been there for a long time. They prefer the high elevation stuff in the Selkirks. It's an inland temperate rainforest, a very unique ecosystem, one of the only ones in the world. And it's, you know, if you've been in the Selkirks, which I'm sure both of you have, I know you have, you know, it's big old growth forest, high elevation cirques that are pretty, you know, predator free, disruption free. And, you know, they're living in these areas because there's arboreal lichen in the wintertime, and then they drop into old growth stuff in the summertime and you know, live at mid elevation.
Mm-hmm. So that they're in part because there's deep enough snow that keeps out or makes it difficult for predators, and partly because they're one of their preferred food sources does well there.
Right. If you've seen these caribou, they have big feet. They're well adapted to deep snow, high elevation stuff that we have in the Selkirks. You know, there's 12 feet of snow at Salmo Pass right now, or at Kootenay Pass. Mm-hmm. So they're living in extreme conditions, and they're one of the only animals that's really well suited to that. So this is kind of the perfect spot for them to be, and they've just adapted to this ecosystem perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Their range, though, they used to cover a larger area, although still somewhat well-defined by these characteristics. Tell us a little bit about that historical range.
You know, pinning down exact historical range is difficult because we end up using a lot of sort of anecdotal or, you know, I don't want to call it folklore, but it sort of ends up being that way. We have points on our map that extend all the way down to like Stanley, Idaho, that are probably pretty questionable, but certainly all the way down, you know, from the Canadian border, the U.S. portion of the range would have extended all the way, you know, south of Priest Lake on the east and the west side in the Selkirks. Molybdenite Ridge in Washington State had caribou on it. North Baldy has accurate records of caribou. So we know they extended south of the border, you know, up to about 50 miles, and we can say that with certainty. Mm-hmm. Recently, that range is obviously contracted for a number of reasons, and one of those might actually just be that the population's contracted. If there was more animals, there's a pretty good possibility that they would expand that range south into more, you know, maybe marginal habitat just due to, you know, social mm-hmm. issues in the herd.
Is there, you said how many are left right now?
We think there's 11.
Yeah. Down from, what was it like at its peak?
That's another one. It's hard mm-hmm. to tell what it was like at the peak. There's a lot of estimates, you know, and a lot of sort of those might just be a guess, but probably stayed between the 100 and 200 mm-hmm. animals. There wasn't ever a huge, robust population just because, you know, their habitat needs are such that they can't pack into an area. They would run out of resources pretty quickly. So they're sprinkled out across the landscape. which made it pretty tough for an accurate estimate.
Mm-hmm.
We think somewhere around 100 to 200 animals would be a fair bet.
Within the Selkirk herd.
Yeah, that would be the, like the U.S. portion of the Selkirks even.
And so at least still in Canada, there's other distinct herds associated with specific mountain ranges.
You bet.
Doesn't seem to be a lot of transfer of individuals, though.
You know, not really. I mentioned the landscape these animals lived in. They live at the high elevation stuff. It's, you know, if you've traveled around the area, you know that those mountain ranges are sort of now isolated island habitats. There's the river valleys are, you know, in Bonner's Ferry and Priest Lake, all the way up through the Kootenays are big, broad river valleys. They're well-developed. There's lots of fence lines, lots of agricultural development, highways, different things like that. So those animals are sort of isolated within their little areas right now. The South Selkirk herd is separated from the Purcells herd by, you know, 30 or 40 miles. North throughout the range, you'll see that as sort of a trend. All of those little subpopulations tend to stay to themselves, and it's not for any reason other than they just really can't realistically move across those valleys safely.
And so for those folks who aren't familiar with caribou, a lot of them might think of the Arctic herds that migrate over vast distances, but those are different than the mountain woodland caribou.
Yeah, we hear that a lot. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of people don't even know we have caribou up here. And then when we tell them we do and that they're endangered, you kind of get a funny look like, well, I've seen National Geographic and there's 600,000 animals in the porcupine herd or, you know, whatever the numbers are up there. They're huge. You know, this is a very different animal. It's a unique animal to the mountainous regions. You know, this animal genetically is very different. You can identify genetically the Selkirk herd from some of the northern herds as well as the barren ground animals. They've been separated, we think, for about 70,000 years. And, you know, in the last ice age, caribou extended all the way across into Pennsylvania and New England and covered a lot of, you know, from the 48th parallel north is kind of what we figure. So, you know, as temperatures changed and things have changed across the landscape, they've sort of moved north. There's still some caribou up in Newfoundland that are close to what we have. But genetically, they're a very different animal.
I assume there had to be some in Maine. I went to college in Maine, and there's a town there called Caribou, which would be an odd name unless there was some legacy.
Yeah, that's a fun thing. There's place names are an interesting thing. You see that all across the border. You know, they have the Caribou Trail over in the Okanagan and places like that. There haven't been caribou there for over 100 years, but those place names still exist, and they're there for a reason.
And yet they still do some elusive things. I think it was 5 or 6 years back, there was a pregnant female caribou that wandered down the west side of Glacier in the Mission Mountain area.
Yeah, there's been, they do. I mean, they're still wild animals. They still travel around and do weird things, and they're still dispersing portions of the population like with any species. You know, the augmentation animals, we tried augmenting the animals into the Purcells, and that went poorly. Those were animals brought in from the north. Again, these animals are specially adapted to move up in elevation in the winter and hang out at the mid-elevation stuff in the summer. The northern animals tend to move down in the winter, which is a more obvious movement for an ungulate in this area. But those northern animals just did not know how to use the landscape. They dropped down in the winter, and they were sort of cannon fodder for the highway and the predators and different things like that. They just never really figured that out.
So let's talk about predators. You've mentioned that a couple times. What animals would typically prey on a caribou?
Cougars are probably the primary predator for caribou. Wolves really get a bad rap right now. Wolf recovery, you know, in this area kind of started 2008, 2009, really picked up some steam. In 2009, the caribou population was climbing. It was up to about 46 animals. Wolf, you know, a couple of wolf packs established in that area, and that additive predation kind of peaked that number at 46, and then you started seeing this decline. And again, you know, this isn't like bashing wolves or anything else. They're just one more predator out on the landscape. So we know lions are really an important predator. We know wolves as an additive predator were sort of the tipping point, like the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, with caribou population.
So there's been work going on some time to help the caribou survive. Tell us a little bit about that history of attempt at recovery.
Well, I mentioned augmentations in the Purcells. The Selkirk herd received augmentations in the early 90s for, I think, every other year for a decade, and they were doing pretty well. Some of those animals didn't respond as well as others. It was a really, if you're familiar with augmentation techniques, there's like a hard release and a soft release. These were all hard release techniques, which means we bring new animals in. These were, again, the northern ecotypes. We dropped them out on the landscape and hoped that they would find their way and hope they would mother up to the herd. And it didn't really happen that way. A few of the animals did. It certainly invigorated the genetics a little bit and increased a little bit of hybrid vigor from the new genetics. And we started seeing this increase after a few years after the last augmentation. And that herd grew from, you know, 27 or 28 animals up to 46 animals within about 5 years. So it was doing pretty well and growing pretty quickly, which is encouraging. It really leads us to think that the habitat controls are sort of in place and working, right? We've got all these things that we've been doing for almost 40 years now with habitat protections, and they keep improving and keep increasing. That habitat is developing, and that herd growth is sort of, you know, tells us that that's what's happening out there. So we feel good about that.
So what are some of those habitat controls?
Well, some of it's just as simple as the Washington portion being almost entirely within the Salmo Priest Wilderness Area. You know, within a wilderness area, there's not going to be any disruption from motorized vehicles. There's not going to be logging activity or a lot of heavy use. So, you know, the Salmo Priest is well protected in the Washington portion. And then, you know, a sort of a moratorium on the old growth logging has helped. I mentioned how important the old growth forests are to caribou. Not cutting down those trees and not building the roads and all the other stuff that goes into those big harvest units has helped caribou. You know, in addition to that, you know, we all talk about how bad it is to stomp out every fire on the landscape, but we can't let those areas burn really either. Some of the fires have been tough on the caribou, the Trapper Peak fire particularly. Mm-hmm. So the habitat protections, insofar as logging and road construction and stuff like that, that's been pretty helpful for caribou.
Mm-hmm. And they really do have a close association with those old growth forests. Is it shelter or is it the availability of the lichen on old growth or a bit of both?
It's a little bit of both. And there's another piece of that that maybe it's not so intuitive is that there's very few predators that venture into old growth forests. Again, caribou are one of these animals that sprinkles out. They're not in high densities. There's not really a good reason for a cougar or a wolf or, say, even a grizzly bear to venture into these big, expansive old growth forests because there's just very few ungulates in there. And the ones that are scattered out like the caribou. They really tend to favor, you know, the predators, I'm sorry, they really mm-hmm. tend to favor cut blocks and harvest units where there's a lot of browse because there's going to be a lot more white-tailed deer, a lot more moose, a lot more elk living there. So we end up with this checkerboard landscape. You might have a square mile of old growth forest immediately adjacent to this square mile of really succulent young browse. And, you know, the predators are just moving through old growth a lot more maybe than they would have historically. And I don't think there's too many predators out there that specifically target caribou, but it's a convenient food source because they're not very good mm-hmm. at getting away from predators. They just have not adapted to a high predator population.
Yeah, it would seem it's hard to develop a taste for caribou if there's only a handful left.
Yeah, yeah. If you're trying to make a living on caribou, you're going to be pretty skinny.
So you work for the Kalispell tribe, and there's a relationship that the tribe and tribes locally have with the caribou. Tell us a little bit about that historical relationship and how that influences the work that the tribes are doing.
Well, historically, caribou were a convenient food source for the tribes. They are an animal that the tribes could, with some effort, find and be pretty successful on a hunt. And when they found the caribou, they were able to take several animals, and they're, you know, they're big. They're 300 or 400 pound animals, so it's a lot of protein. You know, they're, again, their predator avoidance techniques are not well developed. So the tribes were able to figure out, you know, how to circle them and herd them and kill several animals at a time. So they're really an important animal to the tribe that way. And, you know, the Kalispell tribe has been sort of all in on caribou recovery for 10 or so years. And one of the reasons, you know, is that they want to be able to access that resource again in the, by eating them. Mm-hmm. That's why the caribou are so important to the tribe.
The 11 or 12 that, you know, the dozen that are left, are they all together? It's just one herd, or do they, you kind of mentioned that they spread out. Are they more individual or herd?
A little bit of both. So they come together pretty regularly in the winter, and then the cows will take off and they calve in these awful, gnarly, rocky, craggy places. And that's another predator avoidance technique. So they go up into the rocks and they have their calves way at high elevations in really difficult spots to access. And then they will come together, you know, mid to late summer and kind of hang out until after the rut. And in the winter, they move up into the higher elevation stuff. And then when calving season comes, they sprinkle out again. When we were surveying and counting, you know, 30 and 40 animals, we would find them in small groups of, you know, say 5 to 10 animals pretty regularly. We never saw, you know, 40 caribou altogether. And we're happy for that now, even though we do see our whatever dozen animals together somewhat regularly. With avalanche danger being so high this year, that's like on my mind.
Yeah.
If you like, I want them spread out right now.
Spread out a little bit. Yeah. What's the future look like? Are you hopeful?
Well, we're certainly hopeful. You know, we're pretty heavily invested in caribou recovery, and we're doing everything we can right now. The Kalispell tribe is working really hard on caribou recovery and partnering with the Kootenai tribe and agencies. And we wouldn't be doing that if we thought it was just no hope.
Right.
Obviously, it's a dire situation. There's a handful of things that need to happen. If we can get everything in place, it might take a little bit of luck, but we want to see this herd recovered, and we're hopeful to the point that we're going to spend money and commit to it.
So it's probably going to be a combination of things, but the attempts at recovery so far, haven't succeeded, at least in the sense of a long-term prognosis. They're still in decline. So things are shifting. There's new projects on the horizon, and we want to talk about that. I think what we'll do is we'll take a music break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about where the recovery efforts are headed and why there could be a chance for success. So for right now, we're going to switch and listen to a little bit of Jack Gladstone. Jack Gladstone, Tapping the Earth's Backbone. Jack always has a lot of things to say about subjects like our relationship to the land and the animals that inhabit it with us. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, this is the Tuesday Morning Show with hosts Phil Huff, and sitting in this week with me, Jack. Mm-hmm. Another Jack.
Here I am. Yes. So good morning, Phil.
Our guest this morning is Bart George from the Kalispell Tribe, a wildlife biologist. We're talking about caribou and caribou recovery, and this is 88.5 KRFY in Padre. Bart, when we left, we were talking a little bit about why there could be some reason for hope for the future, and obviously, that sustains a lot of people's efforts. Tell us where the recovery effort's going. What's going on now, and how it differs from what's gone on in the past?
Well, yeah, there's definitely hope, and there's also some traction right now. A lot of people are interested in caribou. We have some partners working hard on caribou recovery projects, and you know, the idea right now is like, no holds barred caribou recovery, right? We're trying to pull all of our management levers at one time. And, you know, for the last 30 years, there's been some effort, right? But it's always been piecemeal. It's been some habitat recovery stuff, some snowmobile closure stuff here, some, you know, highway signage or some different things to just sort of address concerns. We're to the point right now where it's so dire. Like, if we don't do all of these things at one time and in a fairly significant way, we know we're going to lose the caribou. So, the Kalispell tribe has been working hard on this maternal penning project, which we'll get more into. We've got grant applications out right now for protection at the Highway 3 because animals get struck there somewhat regularly. That's like a Doppler system that would alert motorists with, you know, flashing signs and different things like that. We've got, you know, there's wolf control effort going on in Canada. They're collaring wolf packs and monitoring their movements. If those wolves, you know, get up and start commingling with the caribou, they're removed. The habitat protections are still in place. The snowmobile closures are still in place. There's lots of things going on. We're trying to get all of these things at once and build a little bit of synergy.
There's a lot of coordination there if you're looking at projects crossing the boundaries of two countries and a couple states and a province. That's a lot of work with a lot of folks. Tell us about the partnership.
The on-the-ground work is really difficult. It seems crazy that we're so close to British Columbia, but it's so different and it's so hard to, you know, just moving materials and goods across the border is really difficult. So that's been a sort of a learning process for all of us. We are working with Canada pretty heavily. The Tanaha tribe is working on the project with us. The Ministry of Natural Resource and Forest Operations is working with us up there. The Kootenai tribe works on both sides of the border fairly regularly. The Kalispell tribe is now figuring that process out. The states are somewhat involved, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Forest Service are both sort of somewhat involved. So it's a big project with lots of moving parts and lots of partners all kind of putting our heads together.
It sounds exciting.
When you did go up and grab a caribou from up, I can only imagine the paperwork that it would take to take a wild animal from northern Canada to the United States.
Well, they only put one group of animals into the United States, and I think that's probably why. The project we're doing right now, we are going to be capturing the caribou from the Selkirk herd and moving them into the pen. And that's a big undertaking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So moving animals across the border at this point, we talked about maybe putting the pen in the United States because the Kalispell tribe is really kind of driving that pen's construction and the management. And it would really be easy if it was next door, but that's just, there's no way to get those animals across the border politically. It's just really hard right now.
Yeah.
With quarantine time and all the different things that you would have to do, it's just not practical.
Did they come across in a cattle truck the first time? Like, how did they actually get here?
They did. They brought them in the livestock trailer.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So this year, when we capture, we're going to be capturing later this month, or what is this? I guess it's still February. We're going to be capturing in March, later in March, and we're going to be using a helicopter and a sling to move these animals because we're only going, 10 or 12 miles. It'll be pretty quick and easy on them.
Mm-hmm.
So where will the pen be?
The pen is on the ground right now. It's already built. It's about 10 miles north of the border. It's up near Salmo, mm-hmm. and it's at high elevation. We wanted to make this as natural for the caribou as possible. So we built the pen in an area, it's at 6,000 feet, which, believe it or not, is not the high elevation country for some of them, but mm-hmm. it's an area that they would spend summers already. So when we put the animals in the pen in late March, we're going to pen the pregnant cows and let them calve and, let those calves live till about 2 or 3 months old. And when we release them, they're going to be pretty close to their normal summer stomping grounds. We think that's pretty important. And we could have built it in the valley really easily, but now we're stuck at 6,000 feet with 12 foot of snow and all the challenges that go with that.
So let's step back a second and take a look at the picture of the penning project and why it's important and what you hope to achieve out of doing that.
Right. Well, we know quite a bit about adult caribou and sources of mortality and different things like that. We've collared quite a few of these animals. They've been studied for, 30 years now. We know what kills adult animals. We know how to sort of protect them. What we don't know much about are the neonates. The young animals, the first month or so of life with any species is probably the most vulnerable portion of their life. So we're losing our neonates. We have fairly low calf return. And we don't really know why. We don't know what's killing them because the calves are born, again, in these high elevation, rocky areas, and surveying them is nearly impossible. So there's, you know, we're not inventing this idea. There are maternal pens already occurring in Canada that have been pretty successful. We're sort of copying those plans, and we're going to capture our pregnant cows, put them in the pen, and let them have their calves, you know, relatively safely for the first, again, 2 to 3 months of their life. At 3 months, a caribou calf's pretty mobile, pretty able to get away from most predators, you know, or as able as they're going to be. And we're hopeful that that's going to increase the calf return.
So does that, if you're transporting a pregnant caribou, does that complicate the transportation more so than if it weren't pregnant?
It does. You know, it does. We have to be careful handling the pregnant animals. We're doing it fairly early in the pregnancy. They're not going to calve until, you know, early June probably. So we're going to have them about midterm. If we got too late in the year due to snow conditions or different issues, we would have to put that project on the back burner. We would not be able to capture late-term animals for fear of just losing the calves.
And capturing them, having them breed in captivity, probably enters a whole new phase of challenges.
You know, that conversation comes up, and we're really resistant to that idea. We're resistant to making our caribou into a zoo specimen. Right. We want them to live on the landscape. We want them to act like wild animals, and that's important to the tribes. We're really reticent to capture and put them in a pen. And
so with that idea, I'm envisioning a fairly large pen, not a small farmyard type thing.
Right. It's a 19-acre enclosure, so pretty sizable. I mean, it's big enough that when you're standing in the middle of it, you can't see the walls. It's a 15-foot-high geotextile fence, so... geotextile is that black kind of stuff they put underneath the highways. So it's a visual barrier. Caribou, they're not really wild. They're fairly easy to keep in captivity. If they can't see through the fence, they're probably not going to try to get out. A bigger concern is animals getting in. So we're putting electric fence on the outside of that geotextile fabric to keep, you know, bears or cougars or wolves or whatever from getting in. And there's also going to be people there pretty much all around the clock, 24 hours a day. We're going to have shepherds on site. They're going to be walking the pen. They're going to be watching for cows to separate and start to calve. And when that happens, we'll capture the young calf and fit it with a small temporary collar so we can monitor its survival through the summer.
What's it like to capture a pregnant caribou? What's that going to be like?
Well,
how many people does it take?
It takes a helicopter crew. Yeah. So there'll be a helicopter crew. I won't be on the capture team. I'm going to be on the ground catching these animals and help them process and collar them and put them in. But the capture crew, it's not really as sciencey as you might think, right? Mm-hmm. They fly up and they net gun it and jump out and like mug it. It's a little bit rough. We have to be careful about where you move those caribou. They live in steep mountainous stuff. If they start barreling down the mountain and trigger an avalanche or something, that would be bad. So you kind of herd them into a fairly gentle, flat cirque, and the caribou sort of pile together. You'll fly through, separate one, and net gun it, and the guys will jump out and mug it.
So they're not drugged. They're fully conscious during the whole thing.
They will be conscious when they're immediately captured, and then they won't be totally anesthetized, but they will be given a tranquilizer just to sort of take the edge off, because it's going to be a stressful situation.
That has to be a fine-tuned thing, too, considering it's a pregnant animal, and you don't want to impact the fetus.
Sure. It is. They've been doing this for a long time in Canada. They know they know the right dosage. They know how to do this without losing animals. There's always a risk when you capture and anything. And we know that we could potentially kill a cow doing this. Obviously, that's the worst case scenario. They captured, you know, 30 of them up at the Clinziza pen last year and didn't kill any. So we feel good about the technique, but we know it's a possibility.
So it's a technique that has been used before. It's not that novel in that sense. It's not experimental.
Right. Yeah, we didn't invent this idea. This has been working for a two different maternal pens are already operating in Canada, and both of them have been successful, one far more than the other, probably due to its location on the landscape. I mentioned we put ours at like the most difficult place to work, but that's where the caribou like to be. The Clinziza pen is where the caribou like to be, and it's been pretty successful. The Revelstoke pen has been a little lower elevation, and when they open those doors, the caribou have to move across a pretty heavily populated area with predators, particularly cougars. And they've lost a lot of animals just moving them from the pen up to that higher elevation where they want to be.
Yeah. So I understand part of this project is collecting lichen to feed to the caribou.
Yeah. You know, caribou are eating lichen this time of year almost exclusively. They, when we put them in the pen, they're going to be accustomed to a lichen diet almost 100%. So the pen is 19 acres. There are obviously some lichen hanging in the trees there. They're probably going to pick at that first, but they need to eat lichen for the first, you know, week or so while we're trying to wean them back onto like a pelletized feed. So a week doesn't sound like that much, but they're eating, you know, 20 or so pounds a day. We need a couple hundred pounds of lichen. And, you know, when you look at a hay bale that weighs 100 pounds, it doesn't seem like that much, but lichen is not very heavy, and it takes a lot of lichen to make 200 pounds.
Now, are you taking the lichen that's hanging from the trees and dangling down here and then hanging them from trees up there, or is it how are you handling it when you're feeding it to them?
It will be, no, we're going to put it in a trough. Yeah. It's just, yeah. It would be too not much work fancy. To do that. Yeah, we're not that fancy. It'll be put in a trough. Yeah. The caribou, you know, again, this is a new project for us, but in the, up north, the caribou have taken to the trough pretty quickly and easily. So the lichen will be fed daily out in these, you know, two or three different locations within the pen.
Now, the lichen's being collected here in the U.S., though.
It is.
Does that complicate things transporting it to Canada?
Well, maybe. It's more, you know.
Or don't, don't bring that up.
We've taken a lot of stuff across the border in the backseat of the car and gotten away with that. But I don't. We're going to have a lot of lichen. Yeah. It's going to be like a truckload. I don't think we're sneaking it across. So Selkirk Conservation Alliance has really taken the lead on lichen collection. They've been doing a great job in organizing volunteers and, you know, scraping the stuff out of the trees. And they've been pretty inventive with ways to gather this stuff using hairbrushes taped to trekking poles and different things to get a hold of it. Once it's in your hand, though, the project's it's only half done. You still have to clean it and dry it and store it. So, you know, the executive director, SCA, Cheryl Moody's garage is like loaded with lichen right now, and they're drying it out in hammocks, it looks like.
And for those who are interested in the lichen collection project, I know that Cheryl's doing a presentation this Saturday to the Native Plant Society here in Sandpoint. It starts at 10 a.m. at the community hall. And if someone's interested in volunteering, they can show up and find out more, or you might have a, do you have a number or a contact form?
I think the easiest way, the way that I'm most familiar with, all of those events get put on the SCA Facebook page.
Selkirk Conservation Alliance.
Yep. You can look there and see when the volunteer efforts are going on. You know, we don't encourage people to go out and do this on their own. Make sure you talk to Selkirk Conservation Alliance before you go gather lichen, because there's different varieties that we want. And there's also permitting issues.
Right.
So, talk with Cheryl. And if you're interested in volunteering, it's a great way to get out and spend a day doing something for caribou.
That sounds like a great project. There's some other things coming up. We're starting to wind down a little bit. We want to make sure we talk about the event that you have coming up.
Yeah. You know, this maternal pen project's expensive, and funding is sort of piecemeal at this point. We're putting things together as we can. One of our sort of our primary funding opportunity right now is an event we're having down at Northern Quest Resort and Casino on March 3rd. It's a dinner, and we're going to be airing the new, David Moskowitz film, The Last Stand, The Vanishing Caribou Rainforest. We're also going to have a panel with the film producers and a couple of biologists. I'll be on the panel. We're going to have Aaron Reed, who's been working on the Caribou Project for the British Columbia Ministry of Environmental Resources. And there'll be auction items and a great dinner and an opportunity to sort of give back that way. And all of the proceeds from that are going to on-the-ground management, which we feel really good about. It's not going to be There's no overhead cost for that. The tribe's supporting the event, and all of that money is going to go directly to the maternal pen in a very tangible way.
The tribe's really been a leader in getting funding for this. Tell us a little bit about the grant that you received.
Yeah, we've been pretty effective at gathering grants for the project. The UCUT group, which is the Upper Columbia United Tribes, we are able to leverage about $80,000 for them, which was enough to get the pen built and get some housing and different things put up there for the shepherds. And then a tribal wildlife grant through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came through. So, you know, we're putting the funding together. We're getting there for sure. We have to fund this thing for 3 years. And one of the sort of caveats to being able to get the permits and put this project together is that we can secure funding. What the government and the agencies don't want to see is all the permits and all the plans and no money. So we're really trying to get ahead on funding, and we're trying to stockpile money, but as you can imagine, it's pretty expensive with transportation and all the different stuff that's going on up there.
It doesn't grow on trees like the lichen.
I wish it did, yeah.
Well, Bart, tell us more about the caribou that we're not asking. What is it that you would like to share that we haven't touched on?
Well, I think we've touched on a lot of the big points. You know, caribou recovery in this area, I think, you know, as I'm walking into the studio this morning, I see this giant caribou mural in downtown Sandpoint, and they're sort of a piece of the local folklore, I guess. And then people talk about caribou here. They're sort of an interesting piece of trivia. When you talk to somebody new to the area, you can tell them about caribou. And it's sort of a unique thing. They're the only animals, the only caribou in the lower 48. And I think if people could get up into that high country and recognize the value of the landscape and the value of the creatures that live there, we would get a lot more energy. So I guess I'm just encouraging people, you know, this summer, take a weekend, get up in that Salmo Priest Wilderness area, get up to Kootenai Pass in BC and go for a walk and see that area, and you'll maybe recognize how special it really is and how unique this area that we live in is.
Mm-hmm. And come out and see the David Moskowitz film. I think it showed here back in December and had a large audience at the Panda. I was unable to make it, but heard good reviews about it. He's a fabulous filmmaker.
It's a really great film. It's only about 35 minutes, but it really covers the whole gamut of issues that caribou are facing in the area. And again, it's a great way to come spend an evening. If you want to learn more about that, we have a website set up. It's kalispelltribe.org/caribou. So take a look there.
More information on the whole project there. You can follow along. And we'll have to have you back on the morning show with the three-year project. We'll like to get an update perhaps after this season's success to see how well it worked.
Yeah, hopefully we'll have some good news for you this summer.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming in, Bart. Enjoyed the conversation. We're going to take a short music break here and come back with the calendar of events. We're going to listen to a little Harry Nilsson, Without You. In 1972, this hit the charts at number one this week. It was his first number one hit, Jack.
I can't believe it.
And believe it or not, he wasn't born today. A lot of times we do this day. He was born yesterday on that day in 1942. So Harry Nilsson, Without You.